The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Everything in the universe was personal, and so everything was personalized, and that the myths were stories to represent this personalness of the world. Well, Strauss argued that the Gospels were written in this kind of world where the only way that they knew how to express truth was by mythological representations. And they undoubtedly believed that in some sense these things really took place. But the important thing was not their taking place. The important thing was what they represented, namely the divinity that is within us. Myth, therefore, is regarded positively by Strauss. It's something good. It's not something bad. In the ancient world, it's something good. It becomes bad if we start thinking of these myths as literal historical truth, but that in themselves they are good, they are pointing to true ideas of Christianity or divinity within humanity. So myth is something that's distinct from historical fact. Historical fact is things that actually happen in the space-time world, which can be demonstrated by historical science, or at least demonstrated to be probable by historical science. And therefore, facts are very distinct from the divine explanations that constitute myth. Myth is, however, an expression of religious truth in symbol, in representation, and we have plenty of that in the Gospels. So myth is something that Strauss regards not as a negative term, but as a positive term, until the modern age. Once the modern age comes, if you still hold on to these myths as literal, then that's bad. But myth in the ancient world is something good. Now, Strauss was not the first to apply categories of myth to the Bible. He was the first to apply them to the Gospels. But in Old Testament studies in Germany, Eichhorn in particular had already applied these categories to the Old Testament, to the stories in Genesis, for example. They were regarded as myth. And nobody thought anything of that. That's probably because in Germany you have a heritage from Lutheranism of a very strong or a sharp distinction between law and gospel. Now, Luther did not draw that law-gospel distinction as equivalent to Old Testament, New Testament. That's not what Luther had in mind. But later Lutheranism did do that and to a large degree regarded the Old Testament as law and old and something that needed to be transcended, whereas New Testament was gospel and truth and the good stuff. So with that kind of ethos, you could get away with saying that the Old Testament was myth because it was, after all, only propaedeutica. It was only stuff that was necessary prior to Christianity. But once the New Testament came, it transcended all that Old Testament stuff. So there wasn't much of a reaction to Eichhorn treating the Old Testament in that way, at least not amongst the society at large. But when Strauss argued that the Gospels are myth, it created a huge backlash. Now, Strauss actually wrote his first draft of his biography of Christ, or his life of Christ, Das Leben Jesu kritisch bearbeitet, which means critically edited or examined, worked over. He wrote this when he was about 27 years old. And there was, as I said, a huge backlash against him. He lost his position at his university, and virtually he was persona non grata for the rest of his life. But anyway, Strauss argued that there are methods by which we can examine the New Testament. We can discern what is fact. We can separate what is fact from what is myth. And in fact, you'll see that most of it is myth. He actually had a methodology. I think this is in Strimple, so you'll see it there as well. I'll just very briefly mention his methodology for discerning myth was simply, first of all, universal laws operate, and therefore anything that violates a universal law has to be a myth. That includes, by the way, psychological laws. So that if certain things happen or are reported to happen in the Gospels which go against the way people ordinarily behave, then that too would be myth. So anything that violates known general laws is a myth. Secondly, if there is a contradiction within an account or a narrative, then that too is a myth. Now, he really didn't deal with questions like couldn't one of the gospel writers have gotten it a little bit wrong, and so simply because there's a little conflict or something doesn't mean that it's necessarily all myth. He really didn't raise that question at all. If there's a contradiction in any of any sort, then that's a sign that that's myth. And thirdly, there are certain positive features which mark a narrative as fictitious or legendary. For example, use of poetical language. If poetical language is used, that's an indication that this is mythological. Or if ideas are based on preconceptions rather than experience, that's mythological. Or anything that stems out of messianic expectation from the Old Testament. If something appears to be a fulfillment of a prophecy, that's a myth. It was invented because there was an expectation that the Messiah would do this. For example, the expectation was that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. So a myth is developed which has Jesus being born in Bethlehem in order to fulfill that prophecy. So those are the three markers then. Universal laws, if it violates a universal law, if there's a contradiction within a narrative or a conflict, and thirdly, if there's poetical language or fulfillment of an Old Testament prediction or anything like that, then that's myth. That was his method. Now you can imagine that once that's applied to the New Testament, you don't get very much left. And in fact, he also had another methodology to work in tandem with that, and that is that anything that was associated with something that was a myth on the basis of some of these other criteria, that too was a myth. So you don't get left with very much. Now, Strauss argued that all this was unconscious, that the apostles were not consciously making up legends and myths in order to deceive people. Rather, the Gospels grew out of a lengthy process of development where the church was variously changing stories. You know how that old game that you play, gossip, where you get a line of people and you tell a story and it goes down and around the line, and by the time it gets to the end, it's radically different. Well, this happened in the church, Strauss argues, with the stories of Jesus. You have a little kernel of historical truth, and that gets blown bigger and bigger and bigger over the course of time. Now, Strauss, as I said, was heavily rejected. He did, however, generate the four basic storm centers of controversy in gospel study that still today occupy scholars. First of all, the question of miracles versus myth. Is it miraculous, or is it something that the early church created in order to exemplify spiritual truth or to exalt Jesus? Second question, the Christ of faith versus the Jesus of history. The Christ that we believe in as a matter of our doctrine is different than, in Strauss, the Jesus who was actually a human being in history. And Strauss is the one who made that divide. Thirdly, John versus the Synoptics. Strauss is the first one to make a sharp break between the Synoptic Gospels and John. Now, both are mythological, but the Synoptic Gospels at least have a kernel of historical truth in them. The Gospel of John is entirely mythological stuff. And then the fourth area of controversy was, Strauss is the first to argue that Christianity is simply one religion among many. There's nothing unique about Christianity. It expresses truth in unique ways, but that Christianity is simply one religion among many and grew up just like other religions grow up. So he analyzed Christianity in the same way that we would analyze, for example, the development of Buddhism. When we come back, we'll discuss the old liberalism. Now, last class, we were discussing the age of historicism and how David Friedrich Strauss, in particular, had developed a kind of consistent historiographical approach in line with rationalistic assumptions, and how radically that changed the approach that had been going on amongst rationalists up to that point, which was to try to explain Jesus' miracles in naturalistic ways. Strauss, remember, had hypothesized that the Gospels are not recording actual events, but that there were naturalistic explanations for those events. Rather, the Gospels, like religious literature in the ancient world generally, were mythological. And therefore, they should be understood as mythic representations of religious truth, not as in some way literally true. And I pointed out as well that Strauss basically began or set the questions, as it were, for subsequent Gospels research amongst critical scholars, namely miracles as opposed to myth. Did miracles really happen, or are they mythological? The Christ of faith versus the Jesus of history. Christ of faith is the religious figure that you believe in. Jesus of history is simply a human being that you can try to get some data on. The Gospel of John versus the Synoptics. And is Christianity unique as opposed to Christianity simply among other religions as another way of presenting religious truth? Well, Strauss did not himself have a great deal of immediate impact of a positive nature on critical scholarship. And there was actually probably three reasons for that. One is the intellectual climate was not quite ready for such a radical approach. I mentioned that Strauss lost his teaching job and really couldn't find any really good post after that for the rest of his life. And it was not pleasant for him. And the reason was simply that people were too upset by this idea that the Gospels were myth. A second reason why Strauss didn't have much of an immediate effect was that Strauss had not really paid a whole lot of attention to the source critical developments that were going on in the 19th century. Strauss simply accepted the Griesbach hypothesis, which we'll talk about in a minute, but basically the Griesbach hypothesis is that Mark combined Matthew and Luke. And for Strauss, it really didn't matter a great deal because all of the Gospels were late and they were all dominated by myth. And a third reason why Strauss did not have much of an immediate effect is because Strauss dated all of the Gospels into the second century. And there was increasing doubts of the viability of second century dating for Gospels material, even amongst critics. And so, because of those issues, critics thought that they could ignore Strauss as some kind of special case, a wacko or something. But they were wrong, because Strauss eventually won the game, as we will see shortly. Now, on your outline of the history of the Gospels, I have just another name there, Ange Renan, a French writer on the Gospels. I'm not going to really mention him other than to, I think Strimple does a little bit on him, but Renan is a kind of romanticized Strauss, as it were. He wants to think of Jesus as a great moral religious teacher, but that the Gospels material are all surrounded by legendary developments, and that Jesus himself actually moved from a kind of apocalyptic kind of preacher to a disillusioned moralist. Renan is again, he didn't have much of a long-term effect. So that brings us to old liberalism. The reason I've called it old liberalism is to distinguish it from the liberalism generally as a word that we use to speak of people that approach the Bible critically. Liberalism, technically, is a specific movement at a specific time, mainly the later 19th century, that climaxes in the work of Harnack and can be summarized. Harnack himself provided the summary as three items, three dogmas, as it were: the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of men, and the infinite value of the human soul. Now, the history of liberalism is really the history of a move towards that culmination of those doctrines. Philosophically, the roots of old liberalism are in Schleiermacher. We pointed out earlier how Schleiermacher had developed the concept of inwardness, or subjectivity, in religion, and was moving away from the concept that religion is primarily concerned with dogmatic metaphysical truths. Schleiermacher was already moving away from that, although Schleiermacher himself apparently held to an exclusivity of Christianity and did hold to some kind of doctrinal objective truth value in Christianity. He was moving away from that, and so the later 19th century began, or continued, this retreat from metaphysics, partly as a reaction to Kant. Kant had, remember, pointed out that our knowledge is always determined by a combination of the experience of phenomena and the mind patterns that are in our brain. And as a consequence, our knowledge is always subjective. So we can never know things in themselves. You can never know the thing in itself. And that is most especially true when it comes to God. You can't even know a chair in itself. So how in the world can you know God or ultimate realities in themselves? So there's this retreat from metaphysics. And the theologian Albrecht Ritschl is the one who gave the initial theological or philosophical basis for old liberalism. He started with the distinction that Kant had made between pure reason and practical reason. Remember that according to Kant, practical reason, assumed God, because the world didn't make any sense unless you assumed God. You have this inward conviction that there is such a thing as morality, and that there's such a thing as good and evil. Where does that come from? Well, you have to assume that there is God and judgment in order for those things to be there, even though you can't prove it by pure reason. Ritschl therefore argued that the true essence of religion is in value judgments, not in metaphysics. That is, its moral quality, not some kind of statements about, for example, what we would call the gospel of redemption. That is, that God had, in an ultimate sense, redeemed people from sin as some kind of object of reality. That was not the focus of religious truth, according to Ritschl. And therefore, the kingdom of God, or the reign of God, was something that was in the heart of the individual. One of the favorite passages of old liberalism was Luke 17:21, where Jesus says, the kingdom of God is within you. It does not come about by perceptions or investigations, but because the kingdom of God is within you, and uses a Greek word, entos. Entos humon. And entos can mean within or inside. It can have that meaning. Now, the purpose here is not to provide an exegesis of Luke 17:21, but entos can also mean in your reach, within your grasp. In other words, you can reach it. Or it can also mean in your midst. And one of those two is probably the better way of understanding it. Either Jesus is saying the kingdom of God is in your midst, referring to himself, or the kingdom of God is within your reach, meaning you can attain to it if you go about it not the way of grasping, but by way of recognizing again that Jesus is the way and he's in your midst. But within you was a possible translation, and in fact that's the way the King James translated it. So that became a favorite verse. The preaching of old liberalism was primarily in terms of social reform. Again, you have some basis here, because the prophets of the Old Testament, many of them had been preaching social reform amongst the people of God in Israel. And, of course, Jesus himself does tell people that they need to love one another. And so this was understood as being the essence of the gospel, the preaching of social reform. All this was also tied up with the kind of optimistic expectation that humankind, was constantly improving. We were coming up from the muck. And so as time went on, humankind was dispensing with their old primitive viciousness and increasingly becoming a loving community. And so the hope was that as time went on, people would get better and better, and eventually we would bring about the kingdom of God on earth by striving for morality and goodness. So that was the expectation of old liberalism. And that rallying cry of the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of men, and the infinite value of the soul, which was Harnack's contribution, dominated the religious scene during the 19th century and early 20th century, even. Okay, now, what about the exegetical foundations of this whole movement?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned that one of the reasons that Strauss was not accepted was failure to grapple with the source critical study that was going on. And it was that source criticism of the Gospels that really provided the exegetical foundation for liberalism. It meant that liberalism could survive. Essentially, when you look at what Strauss said and you read his argumentation is so forceful that you can't imagine how liberalism ever arose after Strauss. Because basically what Strauss said was so consistent and so well argued that it should have entirely prevented liberalism from ever coming to pass, because he demonstrated the weakness of that whole theological venture. He said, if you're going to be critical, you've got to be consistently critical and reject the whole thing as simply a mythological expression of man's striving towards God. So the whole liberal approach, which wanted to have some kind of positive moralistic teacher in Jesus, was already, in a sense, had already had its moorings cut from under it. But they thought they had a foundation in source criticism, and specifically in the Markan hypothesis. The Markan hypothesis is simply that Mark is the earliest gospel. Up until about the middle of the 19th century, most critics had accepted that Matthew was the first gospel, Luke had used Matthew, and that Mark combined Matthew and Luke. Since Matthew was typically dated early in the second century, that meant that all of the gospels had to be dated into the second century. Well, as I said, about the middle of the 19th century, work became increasingly focused on the Gospel of Mark, and the argument was that it looks like Mark is the earliest gospel, not Matthew and Luke, which is the Markan hypothesis, that Mark was the first gospel. Actually, the way it first started out was that it wasn't Mark itself, it was an earlier form of Mark, which the Germans called Ur-Markus, which means early or original Mark. And the feeling was that this early form of Mark held the pure gospel, that is, the moral gospel, the gospel which presented Jesus as a great moral teacher. Even the Gospel of Mark has Jesus doing miracles, for example, but those are later accretions. The essence of the gospel, as it appears in Mark, is Jesus, the great social reformer. Okay, now in order to appreciate why they settled on the Markan hypothesis, what their grounds were, we're going to have to take a little bypass right now and look at the synoptic problem. Now, we have to do this sometime, so this is as good a time as any. Basically, in the history of the church, there have been four major methods of critical study of the Gospels that have developed. We're going to look at the first of these, source criticism, because that was the one that was the foundation for liberalism. The others are form criticism, redaction criticism, and literary criticism. We'll talk about them later. Basically, there were two issues in liberalism that were of interest to them in looking at the Gospels. One was the interest to reconstruct the life and teachings of Jesus. And the second issue is the reconstruction of the theological development of early Christianity. And both of these have some role to play. Now, basically the problem here, as was noticed even as early as Augustine, but really came to the fore as a subject of interest in the end of the 18th and early 19th century, was the fact that the three Gospels are very similar in wording. Now here's, I'll just show you two at a time here. Matthew and Mark, this is the story where Jesus calls his disciples to follow him. If anyone wishes to follow me, he must take up his cross daily and follow me. He must deny himself and take up his cross. And you'll notice that I've underlined in green here the material that is identical, word for word, precisely the same in Matthew and Mark. You'll notice, however, that the introduction here, then Jesus said, or then calling to the crowd with his disciples, he said to them in Mark, apart from the introduction there, you have very, very precise word correspondence here. You have the same thing with regard to Mark and Luke. You'll notice, however, that the introduction here, then Jesus said, or then calling to the crowd with his disciples, he said to them in Mark, apart from the introduction there, you have very, very precise word correspondence here. You have the same thing with regard to Mark and Luke. In Luke's account also is very similar, with one minor exception, the fact that Elthane, the infinitive in Mark, is now Erchestai, the present infinitive, instead of an aorist infinitive. Possibly Luke I don't want to jump ahead of myself there, but I would suggest that possibly Luke has the present infinitive in order to indicate the continual nature of coming after Jesus, but that's not our point here. Our point is simply that you have this very similar correspondence, very close correspondence, in all three Gospels in this case. Now you might say, well, that's not a problem. That's simply because Jesus said things and people remembered him exactly, and God inspired the biblical writers to remember what Jesus said precisely. Well, that doesn't quite work because there are times when there's recordings of the words of Jesus where there's quite a bit of difference between quite a bit of difference in what Jesus said in the wording. If you think about that for a moment. If you were going to report on here's a very down-to-earth example for you. I notice that most of you are taking notes on what I'm saying. And it's possible that some of you, perhaps, may even be able to get precisely, word for word, what I am saying, although I don't know why in the world you'd want to do that, but it's possible you'd get exactly the way I've phrased something in your notes. And then on the exam, I ask you to describe something that I've described in class, and you write on your exam, and you're reporting what I said. Well, I will be honest with you and tell you that if, in grading the papers, I notice that paper A and paper B are reporting on what I said in class, and they're word for word identical, well, I begin to suspect theories of literary dependence. I begin to suspect that one paper has been using another. And that's a problem. That's a question. Okay, who's using whom here? And I try to answer that question as best I can. But I can turn that off. But you get the point then. The people are asking now, explain to me why you have such close similarity, not identity, but very close similarity. And the problem is compounded by the fact that the similarity is in Greek. Well, the likelihood is very strong that when Jesus said, if anyone wants to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, the likelihood is very strong that Jesus actually spoke that in Aramaic. Now, again, if you ask two people to translate something, even exactly the same words, from one language into another, they're not going to come out anything like each other. The meaning will be approximately the same, but the words will be quite different. So, there's this question, why is it that they are so close? Well, that's the nature of the problem, the similar wording. But that's not the only part of the problem. There's also another aspect of the problem in that there is a similarity in the order or the chronology. Let me just put up an example here for you. You actually have basically a very, very similar outline between the three Gospels. I mentioned earlier in the course how the basic structural framework is echoed in all of the Gospels, but especially the first three Gospels, you have very, very similar chronological development. Again, it's not identical. We'll look and see some of these non-identities in a moment. But for example, here early in the baptism of Jesus and the early stories in the Gospels, you can see that to a large degree you have an identity between Matthew, Mark, and Luke in reporting these materials. You have some extra material that occurs, say, in Matthew and Luke here, and you have some extra material about the story of John the Baptist being imprisoned, which here is in Luke, but not in the other Gospels. You also have a genealogy here in Luke, whereas the genealogy is earlier in Matthew. But to a large degree, you have very similar correspondences. Once you get thoroughly into the Gospel, there are still a great deal of correspondences, but there tend to be disruptions. So, for example, here, this particular account of the enthusiasm of the crowd in Galilee when Jesus is preaching in Capernaum is in all three Gospels in the same place, in the same order. But for example, what immediately follows that in both Mark and Luke is this story of an unclean spirit, but Matthew doesn't have that. On the other hand, following that, this healing of Peter's mother-in-law is next, but is delayed in the Gospel of Matthew. On the other hand, up here, the calling of Peter and the three disciples in 4:18-22 of Matthew and chapter 1 of Mark, that's in the same place in Matthew and Mark, but Luke has that material later. So you have these little disruptions, but basically a very similar chronology, chronological development. So, with those factors in mind, the fact that you have a very similar but not quite identical chronology, and that you have many places very similar wording but also quite different wording at times, you have this question, how do you explain the similarities? The differences are not too hard to explain. Well, there were different people writing at different times. It's the similarities that are the problem, the question, as it were. And so the synoptic problem is simply the question, why are the Gospels, or the first three Gospels, so similar? Okay, well, there is some early evidence as to where the Gospels developed or how they developed that we should bear in mind. Eusebius reports that Papias, probably writing in the middle of 2nd century, says that Mark was Peter's scribe. That John Mark, the author of the Gospel of Mark, was transcribing the preaching of Jesus. But Papias adds the words, but not in order. The difficulty is, what did Papias mean there? Did he mean not in the order that they happened, or not in the order that Peter preached them? It's not exactly clear what Papias means. Also, Papias makes reference to logia, or sayings, of Jesus, of Matthew, a logia of Matthew. But Papias adds material saying that it was written in the Hebrew dialect, and each one interpreted them as he was able. And that, again, raises questions. Well, what in the world is Papias saying here? Is he saying that it was written in Hebrew or Aramaic, and that those people who knew Aramaic tried to interpret it into Greek as they were able? Or is it simply saying that it was written in the Hebrews' particular way of expressing themselves in Greek, and that each one interpreted them, that is, not translated them, but simply interpreted them as he was able? Again, it's not clear what Papias had in mind there. By the time of Clement of Alexandria, who was writing towards the end of the 2nd century, there seemed to be a tradition that the Gospels with genealogies, that is, Matthew and Luke, were written prior to those that do not have genealogies. And that was kind of the starting point of most thinking up until the 19th century. Now, there are four basic approaches to explaining the similarities. The first approach is utilization. So the first idea is that Matthew, that one of the Gospels used one of the other Gospels. And this has its earliest expression in Augustine. Augustine argued that Matthew was used by Mark, that Mark simply took Matthew and abbreviated it. So the first explanation that arose was that of utilization. The second view that arose was that there was an earlier form of the gospel. I said utilization theory developed with Augustine. That was accepted up until the end of the 18th century. And at the end of the 18th century, three other ways of approaching the problem arose. So these are all at the end of the 18th century. Lessing, remember Lessing of Lessing's Ditch that we talked about earlier? He had argued that there was a proto-gospel, an earlier form of the gospel, probably in Aramaic, that was used by the three gospel writers. There was, secondly, a tradition hypothesis, which was an oral tradition hypothesis, developed by a fellow named Herder, H-E-R-D-E-R, in 1797. This was the idea that early in the history of the church, the disciples formulated an oral form of the gospel, and that this oral form was to a high degree memorized and disseminated throughout the world. If I can give you a modern illustration, just like today, young Christians who are anxious to evangelize and get involved with Campus Crusade will memorize the four spiritual laws, and they simply memorize this little presentation, and that has a certain order to it, and many times certain wording. You have certain scripture texts that you memorize, and that provides a kind of basic framework for evangelism in the mode of Campus Crusade. Well, Herder's view was that on a much more extensive level, this is what had happened in the early church. They memorized certain Old Testament texts, and they memorized certain sayings of Jesus, and they memorized a certain order of presentation or order of telling the story. And that explains the similarities. And then the fourth view was the multiple source theory. That is, that there was more than one source and that they got combined. Maybe these sources were written, maybe they were oral, but in any case, they got mushed together in various ways. This was developed by a Cambridge scholar named Marsh, William Marsh, I think, in 1795. And so here at the end of the 18th century, these three other viewpoints are arising. Now, as it happens, all of the theories that have arisen since then are basically combinations of these three of these four basic approaches. I'll just briefly run through some of these. Again, these are on the outline that I gave you, so I'm not expecting you to remember all these names and dates. I'm expecting you rather to remember the most significant people in the development and the general flow, the general way in which it is developed. Before Holtzmann, Holtzmann provides the kind of watershed in the 19th century. So we're going to talk about before Holtzmann and after Holtzmann. Before Holtzmann, I mentioned Augustine argued that Mark simply abbreviated Matthew, and that Luke then used both Matthew and Mark. And that was accepted by pretty much everybody that even thought about the question up until the 19th century, the 18th century. And then we already mentioned Lessing's idea of an earlier form of the gospel. Now, kind of giving an impetus to this whole development was a work by a scholar named Kopp, K-O-P-P-E, that argued that, or actually that pretty well demonstrated to the satisfaction of most people, that Mark was not abbreviating Matthew. Now, actually, Calvin had already anticipated this to some degree. Calvin said Calvin is referring to Jerome, who's really echoing Augustine here, but Calvin said there is no ground whatever for the statement of Jerome that his gospel, that is, that Mark's gospel, is an abridgment of the gospel of Matthew. And Calvin pointed out that sometimes Mark differs in order, sometimes he handles things differently, and sometimes he includes material that is not found in Mark. In Matthew, rather. So already Calvin, although Calvin wasn't really interested in the question of sources, he had already begun to think that maybe Augustine was wrong. Kopp argued that all three evangelists independently used pre-existent sources. That is, that they were all using sources, but not each other. Mark sometimes deviates from Matthew, both in order and in content, in a way that an abbreviator would never do. And when he does deviate from Matthew, he pretty consistently agrees with Luke, and almost always in order and frequently in content as well. So Mark is not simply abbreviating Matthew. Now, the theory that then arose and that kind of ruled the day for more than half a century was Griesbach. Almost 100 years, in fact. Griesbach agreed with Kopp and argued that Luke had used Matthew, and that then Mark wasn't simply abbreviating Matthew, Mark was rather combining Matthew and Luke. You see on your paper there a whole lot of other scholars as well. I think I'm going to skip most of those because they're basically variations on a theme, and I'll just touch on the highlights. Herbert Marsh, we already mentioned. I said Williams, Herbert. Herbert Marsh, we already mentioned. Herbert Marsh is important because he was the first to suggest that, he challenged Griesbach's hypothesis in that the problem of omission is maximal, is the greatest if Mark is the last. Now, why did Mark omit so much if he was combining Matthew and Luke? And in fact, why did Mark omit some of the best stuff and rather expand on some of the less significant material? So Marsh had argued that there was a Greek translation of an Ur gospel, an earlier Aramaic gospel, which he designated Aleph, and a saying source, which he designated Beit, and that bait contained the material, particularly sayings material, that was found in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. It also contained stuff that was found only in one of the Gospels. And so the result was that Marsh attempted to reconstruct this earliest form of the Gospel and the earliest sayings source, and said that the three Gospels were a result of using these two sources. Well, as a pragmatic matter, it turns out that the Ur Gospel that Marsh thought of is virtually identical to Mark. And so Marsh in some ways anticipates the two source theory that we have later in Holtzmann. Okay, well, we're going to have to break there. We'll come back and finish up on this prehistory of the synoptic problem. Lachmann is important not so much for his own theory, but for something that he observed in the course of development of the theory regarding the phenomenon of order. And that simply is that when Matthew and Luke diverge, when something is found in all three Gospels, if Matthew and Luke have it in a different place, Mark will agree either with Matthew or with Luke. In other words, Mark will go one way or the other. Where Matthew and Luke have the same order, Mark will always agree, or almost always agree, with Matthew and Luke in that order. This is Lachmann's observation, that simply that Mark is in some way or another occupying a middle view, a middle position. You never have it. In other words, it's never the case that Matthew and Luke will agree in order against Mark. So Matthew and Mark will agree against Luke, and Mark and Luke will agree in order. I'm not talking about wording. Luke and Mark will agree in order against Matthew, but it never happens that Matthew and Luke agree in order against Mark. So Lachmann argued that, Lachmann himself, his own theory, was a combination of Marsh and Schleiermacher. It was beginning to go the direction of Markan hypothesis. But anyway, he didn't himself think that he had proven anything, because that also works for the Griesbach hypothesis. If Mark is combining Matthew and Luke, you can easily see why Mark would either agree with Matthew or Luke when they happen to disagree. So the Lachmann observation is this observation of order, a peculiarity that Matthew and Luke never agree in order against Mark when something is in all three Gospels. Now, there are a couple of things which are in Matthew and Luke and are in the same place that Mark doesn't have. For example, the story of the temptation of Jesus. Mark just has that he went and got tempted, but Matthew and Luke actually have the material, the content of the temptations. But that's material that is not found in Mark, and the little sentence that is in Mark does correspond to it in order. So it's simply a matter of if it's on all three Gospels, then Matthew and Luke do not agree against Mark. That's the Lachmann observation. Okay, skipping out now down to Holtzmann. Holtzmann is the watershed, as I said. Heinrich Julius Holtzmann, in 1863, which is the year that West Virginia became a state, Holtzmann, that's how I remember it, you see. Holtzmann wrote the Synoptic Gospels. Their origins and their spiritual character, as I said, 1863. Basically, Holtzmann had taken this material that was being developed earlier in the 19th century and brought it all together. And his view was what we now call the classic two-source theory. which was that the earliest gospel, which he called Ur-Marcus, an earlier form of Mark, and a sayings source, which was designated Quella, which means simply source or spring in German. And Holtzmann had argued that Matthew and Luke and Mark had used Ur-Mark, and that Matthew and Luke had used Ur-Marcus and this sayings source, Quella, or source. Now, Holtzmann had the advantage of over earlier exponents in two ways. One is simply that he argued his case so carefully and so well, with a very judicious use of data, but not in such a technical fashion that it overwhelms you. So that was one reason, is simply it was well argued. The other reason was that Holtzmann addressed it in a way that gave support to the whole liberal Life of Jesus movement. Now, liberalism was more than any other phase in the whole story of Gospels research, was involved in writing lives of Jesus, that is, writing biographies of Jesus. Who was this great religious figure anyway? What was his life really like, so that we can live like he did? That was the interest of liberalism, and there were hundreds and hundreds of liberal lives of Jesus that were written. In fact, you can go to, I believe it's Union Seminary in Virginia, I think, that actually has a library specifically specifically of this Life of Jesus stuff. And there are just shelves and shelves and shelves. There's probably over thousands of volumes on the life of Jesus that was written during this time. But in any case, Holtzmann's advantage was that he appealed to this. He said that his theory now was support for an optimistic approach to writing a biography of Jesus. Remember that Strauss had argued that all of the Gospels were mythological and were written in the second century, so they were just unreliable for history. So you couldn't write a biography of Jesus because all these sources were late. So you really couldn't know what Jesus really said and did. But liberalism wanted to have a great moral teacher in Jesus. How do you recover him? How do you write a life of Jesus if you don't have reliable source material? Well, Holtzmann's theory had an early form of the gospel. Okay, so now by now, Matthew and Luke are being dated probably early second century, maybe even tail end of first century. So if Matthew and Luke are dated around 100, then that means that Ur-Marcus and Quella have to be earlier than that. So now we're back maybe to, say, the 60s or 70s, okay? Maybe 60s. That's close enough to the actual living disciples that you now have a historically reliable source for uncovering a life of Jesus, namely Mark, or an expurgated Mark, a Mark relieved of some of its legendary accretions. So you see now, they could now have their Jesus and their rationalism too. They could have a great moral teacher, somebody that was a religious figure, somebody that they could attach themselves to religiously, and at the same time had a critical, a scholarly basis for in the two-source theory. And as you can imagine, it took off like wildfire, because all of the old Griesbach hypothesis, everything was late, it was really tough to have a Jesus that you had any confidence in, that you'd really found out who Jesus was. But Holtzmann gave a lot of confidence that we could know who Jesus was. Okay, after Holtzmann, as I said, it began to sweep the field and increasingly had an acceptance amongst scholars. There were noises to the contrary, and in particular, there were two noises that I will mention here. One was B.F. Westcott, the great British evangelical teacher and bishop. And he wrote an introduction to the study of the Gospels, and he revitalized the Herder tradition, argued that that the Gospels were the products of oral tradition, both on a small scale, that is with regard to wording and remembrance of particular stories, but also on a large scale. That is that the oral gospel existed as a large unit that people memorized a great deal. And he could argue that on the basis of work on Homer. Homer, it was discovered, wasn't the originator of all that material, such as the Odyssey. He was simply the one who coalesced it and wrote it down, and that actually this had an oral existence prior to Homer. Well, Westcott then challenged the two-source theory and said that there's no evidence for any existence of Quella. The only evidence for Urmark is Mark itself. You don't really have an Urmarkus, and it's purely hypothetical as to what constituted it. You can just eliminate whatever you don't like. That's not a good way to handle sources. And so Westcott argued for an oral source. However, Westcott was pretty well ignored.